You're scrolling through your social media feed, right? And suddenly there it is.
Yeah, a shaky, chaotic cell phone video.
Exactly. Usually filmed from a distance, maybe a parking lot or, you know, a crowded subway platform. You see a frantic physical struggle, two people grabbing, pulling, maybe tumbling to the ground.
Right.
And right above it, a headline that immediately passes judgment, like off-duty cop fights civilian. We all watch it. And usually within, what, 10 seconds?
Oh, easily. Less than that, even.
Yeah, within 10 seconds, we've acted as judge, jury, and executioner. We decide who the villain is based on a tiny, blurry window into a chaotic event. But what does the law actually see when it looks at that exact same chaos?
Well, it sees something entirely different. I mean, we are culturally conditioned to look at a messy physical encounter and instantly categorize it as mutual wrongdoing.
Like two people who just couldn't keep their tempers in check.
Exactly. But the legal framework doesn't operate on visual aesthetics. It demands a highly disciplined, sequential approach to understanding human behavior, specifically human behavior under extreme pressure.
So today we're doing a deep dive into why our eyes deceive us in these moments and what the law actually requires. We are pulling from this incredibly detailed legal analysis by civil rights and police defense attorney Eric Sanders.
It's a fascinating piece of writing.
It really is. He takes a reported incident involving an off-duty NYPD Assistant Chief Benjamin Gurley to sort of explain the hidden legal machinery of self-defense.
Right. And according to the reports, Gurley intervened in an alleged harassment of his daughter.
Mm-hmm. And the situation escalated into a physical struggle. And during that struggle, his firearm discharged. Now, I want to be explicitly clear right up front. We are not taking a side on the guilt or innocence of anyone involved in this specific event.
Absolutely not.
The facts are still under active investigation by local authorities and the police department. We're just looking at the source material.
Right. Our focus is purely on the legal framework Sanders highlights. He uses this real-world scenario to unpack New York Penal Law Article 35.
Which is the actual statute, right?
Yeah. It's the statute that dictates how the law evaluates when any physical intervention, especially an off-duty one, is legally justified.
And it really reveals why the collective public rush to condemn an action based on a partial video fragment or, you know, based on loaded terminology, fundamentally misunderstands how the justice system operates.
It completely misses the mark.
Cool, let's unpack this, because we should start with one of the biggest misconceptions Sanders dismantles. There's this pervasive idea floating around that if you are an off-duty officer, or honestly, even just a regular civilian, and you see a dangerous situation, your only legal option is to, like, pull out your phone, dial 911, and just stand there taking a video while someone gets hurt.
Yeah, it's a massive myth. And Sanders points right to the specific text of Article 35 to correct it.
Why?
The statute doesn't carve out an exception that says, you know, only civilians can defend themselves. It doesn't say only on-duty police officers in full uniform.
It's broader than that.
Much broader. The language is straightforward. It applies to a person. It allows a person to use physical force when and to the extent they reasonably believe it is necessary to defend themselves or a third person from what they perceive as imminent, unlawful physical force.
Calling 911 is obviously the tactically sound move in a vacuum anyway.
Yeah.
But physical violence unfolds in seconds.
Right.
A police response, even a fast one, takes minutes. The law doesn't legally require you to be helpless, does it?
No, it really doesn't. It doesn't require a father, a mother, an off-duty officer to just stand paralyzed on the sidewalk and watch a family member be assaulted just because they don't have a badge pinned to their chest at that exact moment.
Right. But the problem begins with how we talk about these events, doesn't it? Like the vocabulary we casually use every day completely poisons the legal well.
Oh, absolutely. We call these interventions a fight or an altercation. And when you use those words, you are inadvertently making a legal conclusion before the investigation has even started.
I mean, calling a defensive intervention a fight is like calling a firefighter running into a burning building an arson enthusiast.
That's a great analogy.
It completely erases the motive and the necessity of the action.
Yeah.
But if you're listening to this and you've ever called 911, you might be thinking, wait, if I see two people wrestling on the asphalt in front of a grocery store, I'm going to tell the dispatcher there's a fight.
Sure.
So isn't it fair for observers to use that word?
Well, it is entirely fair for a civilian bystander to use that word to describe the visual surface of what they are seeing.
Right.
If you tell a 911 dispatcher there's a fight, that is a very useful shorthand to get police officers dispatched to the scene, what law enforcement calls a radio run. You need to convey urgency.
You just need them to get there fast.
Exactly. But what is useful for a dispatch emergency is legally incomplete. Fighting implies mutual combat. It paints a picture of two willing participants engaged in a personal grievance, like a duel. Mm. Article 35 requires investigators to ask an entirely different set of questions. Like, was one person intervening to protect someone else? Was one person simply trying to restrain an unprovoked aggressor? Was someone trying to prevent a weapon from being taken?
So the law isn't concerned with what it looked like from 50 feet away through a dirty windshield. It is concerned with why the physical force was initiated in the first place.
Right. The motive is everything.
And once we establish that the underlying reason is what matters, we have to draw a hard line between a lawful protective action and illegal retaliation.
Yes. Which can get incredibly thorny.
Especially when family is involved. People hear a phrase like, a father protecting his daughter. And society's mind immediately jumps to vigilantism. We picture someone taking the law into their own hands to settle a score.
But the law does not demand emotional neutrality. You don't have to be a detached robot to act lawfully under Article 35.
So you can be angry.
Oh, absolutely. A parent can be terrified, adrenaline-fueled, and furious, and still act entirely within the bounds of lawful self-defense. The distinction between vigilantism and lawful defense is entirely based on a timeline.
Okay, so what does this all mean for the timeline? Because if the timeline dictates what is legal, I'm assuming that once the initial threat steps back or turns to walk away, any physical force used after that isn't defense anymore. It's just revenge.
You've hit on the exact legal mechanism there. Vigilantism is inherently backward-looking.
Mm-hmm.
It is punishment for a prior grievance. Lawful defense is forward-looking. It is protection from an immediate impending threat. Let's apply a concrete timeline test here.
Let's do it.
Imagine the alleged harassment of a daughter had completely ended. The harasser has turned their back and is walking to their car. There is no imminent physical threat to anyone.
Right.
If a parent runs up and tackles that person from behind to punish them for the verbal abuse that just occurred, that is unlawful retaliation. That is vigilantism.
Because the threat was over. You can't hit the rewind button and settle the score.
Exactly. But flip the timeline. If the harasser is actively threatening, stepping aggressively into the daughter's personal space, or initiating unlawful physical force in that exact second, stepping in to physically intervene is lawful defense.
Okay, that makes sense.
And under Article 35, the use of force has to stop the millisecond the threat stops. If you tackle the aggressor and they submit, you cannot throw three more punches just to make a point.
But wait, if I'm the listener hearing this, I'm thinking, where's the line drawn on who starts it?
Right.
Let's say someone is verbally harassing a family member, and I step in between them, physically creating a barrier.
Okay.
I put my hands up to create space.
Yeah.
And then the harasser swings at me. Haven't I technically created the physical danger by injecting myself into the middle of it? Doesn't that make me the aggressor?
That brings us to what the legal system calls the initial aggressor doctrine. This was heavily examined in a landmark New York case called People v. Petty.
Right. Sanders mentions that.
He does. And the core takeaway from that legal precedent is that the person who throws the first punch or who makes the first physical contact is not automatically the legal initial aggressor.
Oh, well. So if I step in to separate two people and my goal is simply to prevent harm,
yeah.
I am not manufacturing danger. I'm managing it.
Yes, precisely. If the other person then escalates that separation into physical violence by attacking you, your subsequent restraint of them or your defense of yourself is lawful.
Okay, but I assume I can't just shove someone for no reason.
Right. You cannot intentionally provoke a physical confrontation, say, by shoving someone violently and unprovoked just so you can claim self-defense when they hit back. But stepping between a victim and a threat is considered protection, not provocation. The law demands that investigators look at the specific conduct that created the need for defensive force, not just who made the first dramatic movement on a video.
But the problem with the timeline test, though, is that the public rarely gets to see the whole timeline. We only see what the algorithm serves us, which is usually a surveillance video or a cell phone recording that starts halfway through the struggle.
Yeah, we almost never get the full context.
Judging a messy real-world intervention by a 10-second Twitter clip is like reviewing a movie by only watching the climax scene with the sound muted.
That's a really good way to put it.
You miss the dialogue. You miss the slow buildup of tension, and you completely miss the stakes.
Because real physical intervention is incredibly ugly. If you have to pull a grown adult off a victim or grab someone's arm forcefully to prevent a strike, it is going to look incredibly aggressive on a video clip that starts 5 seconds too late.
It's going to look like you're attacking them.
Exactly. But Article 35 doesn't require defensive intervention to look neat, tidy, or choreographed. However, it also doesn't just take the person's word for it after the fact.
Right. You can't just sit in an interrogation room and say, well, I felt like I was in danger, and have the case closed.
No, not at all. Sanders brings up the Guts standard, stemming from the famous People v. Goetz case involving a subway shooting in the 1980s. That case cemented how New York evaluates self-defense.
And what did that case establish?
That justification isn't purely subjective. It isn't enough that you genuinely felt afraid. Your belief must be objectively reasonable under the specific circumstances you faced in that exact moment.
Mm-hmm.
The legal system has to evaluate the threat based on what you saw, the speed of the encounter, the lighting, the physical positioning of the people involved, and whether a hypothetical reasonable person in your shoes would have perceived the same imminent threat.
So how does the law handle the fact that an off-duty police officer might see a subtle, what are they called, a pre-assault cue, something that looks like absolutely nothing to a civilian bystander recording on their phone?
Right, like they see something we don't.
Yeah. Maybe the suspect drops their shoulder, blades their stance, or subtly shifts their weight toward the officer's weapon side.
Mm.
To a bystander on a balcony, it looks like two people just having a heated argument. But to the officer, those tiny movements scream that an attack is coming in a fraction of a second.
Well, police training acts as a double-edged sword in these legal evaluations.
How so?
On one hand, an officer's extensive training heavily informs that reasonableness inquiry we just talked about.
Mm.
A trained officer might recognize weapon access movements or positional danger much faster than an untrained person.
Right.
This provides legal support for why they felt an imminent threat existed, even if the viral video looks relatively benign to a layperson. The officer is perceiving data the camera doesn't capture.
So training gives them almost an X-ray vision for threats.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine it also puts them on a much tighter leash when it comes to stopping the force.
It definitely does. Training significantly raises the expected level of judgment. A trained officer is legally and administratively expected to understand proportionality. They are expected to utilize de-escalation techniques, if time permits, to be hyper-aware of bystander danger, and to respect that absolute obligation to stop using force the millisecond the threat ends.
So they can't just react blindly.
Right. The law requires investigators to painstakingly reconstruct the actor's reasonable perception at the time the decision was made. It doesn't allow judgment based on the perfect, detached hindsight of someone watching the video from their couch 3 days later.
And as messy and chaotic as a physical struggle is on video, adding a firearm to the mix fundamentally changes the legal stakes, right?
Right.
We transition immediately from the realm of standard physical force into the threshold of deadly physical force.
Completely.
When an armed off-duty officer gets into a physical struggle, the firearm itself becomes the central point of danger.
Yeah, what starts as an ordinary physical altercation can instantly, in the blink of an eye, shift into a potentially deadly weapon retention emergency.
Just because the gun is there.
Exactly. If the suspect notices the concealed weapon during the grappling or feels it on the officer's waist and makes a grab for the gun, the legal dynamic completely flips.
Wow.
The officer is no longer just trying to break up a harassment incident. They are suddenly fighting to prevent their own murder and potentially the murder of everyone else in the vicinity.
Now, in the reported Gurley incident that Sanders analyzes, a shot was fired during the parking lot struggle. Thankfully, no one was hit.
Right.
But hold on. If I'm listening to this, I'm definitely pushing back here.
Yeah.
If an off-duty chief brings a gun into a parking lot dispute and a struggle ensues where a shot rings out in a public place, even if no one is hit, doesn't the sheer risk to innocent bystanders automatically make that action criminally reckless?
What's fascinating here is that the legal analysis requires absolute precision. Sanders notes that the term accidental discharge is a massive umbrella. It covers several vastly different legal realities. Like, was the discharge the result of negligent handling by the officer? Was it reckless endangerment because the officer pulled the gun out as an intimidation tactic when it wasn't warranted?
Right.
Or was it an unintended discharge caused by a suspect actively trying to rip the weapon from the holster to kill the officer?
So the presence of risk alone doesn't automatically equal a crime. The law wants to know who actually created the unjustifiable risk.
Precisely. Physical struggles involving firearms are dangerous by definition. There is no safe way to fight over a gun. The legal question is whether the risk was unjustifiable and who introduced it.
Mm-hmm.
If an officer unnecessarily pulls a firearm in a non-deadly argument just to assert dominance, that is incredibly problematic both legally and administratively. But if the officer was lawfully defending someone using empty hands, and the suspect lunged for the officer's waistband to take the weapon, the officer is now in a fight for their life. A stray shot in that scenario demands intense, rigorous investigation, but the law does not lazily collapse a fight for survival and reckless endangerment into the exact same category.
Which brings up the ultimate, terrifying vulnerability of the off-duty officer. They have what Sanders calls invisible authority.
Yes.
When an officer is off-duty wearing jeans and a t-shirt, nobody around them knows they are the quote-unquote good guy.
Invisible authority is incredibly dangerous. I mean, think about the identification problem from the perspective of others.
Right.
To a panicked 911 caller looking out a window, an off-duty officer who has drawn a weapon to stop a threat just looks like an active shooter.
It's terrifying.
And to responding uniformed officers who pull up to the scene with sirens blaring, that off-duty officer holding a gun looks exactly like the aggressor they were called to stop. It creates a terrifying potential for friendly fire.
And police departments try to manage this massive risk through internal policy. They instruct officers to prioritize bystander safety and to verbally identify themselves as police when tactically safe.
That's the policy, yes.
But I can easily imagine scenarios where yelling, "I'm a cop," during a struggle could actually make things worse. It might make a desperate suspect fight harder to avoid arrest or prompt them to immediately reach for your gun.
This highlights a massive point of public confusion that Sanders points out. There is a vast difference between administrative department policy and statutory criminal law.
Okay, break that down for us.
A police department might investigate an incident and decide to discipline an officer for poor tactics. Maybe the officer failed to call 911 first, or maybe their intervention created an unnecessarily chaotic situation.
Well, they broke the rules.
Right. Those are policy violations. They break the department's internal rules. But violating a department policy is not the same thing as committing a crime under New York Penal Law Article 35.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It's like the difference between getting fired from your corporate job because you violated the employee handbook versus going to state prison for breaking the law.
That's a perfect comparison.
They are two totally different rule books governing the same behavior. But if an officer is put on modified duty while the investigation happens, why does the public immediately interpret that as a quiet confession of criminal guilt?
Because the public tends to treat process as outcome. We want clean, easily digestible narratives. We want a clear hero and a clear villain.
Well, it's easier that way.
So when an officer is placed on modified duty or their badge and gun are temporarily secured, the assumption is that the department knows they committed a crime. But modified duty is simply administrative risk management.
It's just a precaution.
Exactly. It protects the integrity of the ongoing investigation and protects the municipality from liability. The justice system has to be capable of identifying criminal liability, a tactical failure, a policy violation, and fully justified defensive conduct as completely distinct categories. When we collapse a policy violation into an assumption of criminal guilt, we actually ruin true public accountability because we demand a simple binary answer in situations that are incredibly complex and legally gray.
So, to wrap this all up, the core takeaway from Sanders' analysis of Article 35 is that being off-duty does not mean an officer or a citizen is legally required to be powerless in the face of violence.
Right.
Lawful intervention requires immediate real-time judgment under immense stress. It does not mandate paralysis, but it also requires something of us. It requires the public to have the discipline to wait for the full sequence of facts.
We have to.
We have to stop relying on viral videos that start too late. Stop using loaded words like fighting to describe self-defense, and stop assuming that the mere existence of an investigation equals guilt.
The law requires patience and discipline from everyone. A visually messy intervention does not mean an unlawful one. A highly emotional response from a parent does not equal vigilantism. And a thorough investigation is a pursuit of facts, not a predetermined verdict.
Think about that shaky 10-second cell phone video we talked about at the beginning, the one that instantly triggers a tidal wave of outrage in the comments section. If we, as a society, continually rush to legally condemn any intervention just because it looks chaotic on a tiny screen, What behavior are we actually incentivizing?
That's the real question.
Are we inadvertently training both police officers and everyday citizens to simply stand back, pull out their phones, and quietly watch while vulnerable people are assaulted? If absolute perfection becomes the only acceptable standard for self-defense, do we risk losing our basic humanity in the process? Thank you for joining this deep dive, and keep questioning the headlines.